I'm really interested in where Edmonton's donair shops get their meat from. And I haven't like started to ask and do research, but I do know, like, for instance, if you go north of the Yellowhead and on my way, say trying to get to Sunbaked Pita, you go by a place called Aladdin Donair, and it's not a shop. It's like a production facility, and they make donair rolls. What do you call
skewers?
It? Yeah. Whatever, like, you call the enormous, like, yeah, swords that have a cylinder of donair meat impaled on them. And I started to think about where my favorite donairs in the city come from, and like, how different are they? Like, they're probably, like, it's almost certain that they're not making them in house, but I don't know. Like, it seems like there's plenty of suppliers for it. And when I think about my favorite ones, could I really tell the meat apart in a blind tasting? And is it just like they all get it from the same place? Or I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't know. I do think that they carry them in the freezer section at wholesale, like at Real Canadian Wholesale Club. I'm pretty sure you can buy a donair meat skewer in there.
That makes sense. But it's just funny because, like, I guess as a lunch offering or a late night offering, like counter service kind of place, donairs are pretty consistent. Some are better than others, but like, it's a pretty uniform experience at Edmonton.
It's pretty rare that you get one that you're like, whoa, this is not what I expected.
Right. And the like, in the last year, say, the two places that I had a donair, I was like, oh man, this is a good donair. one weird place on the West End that has two names. It's called Just Donair's Shaw's Kitchen. It's like Just Donair / Shaw's Kitchen. The other one, what was the other one? Oh, Simon King Donair.
Okay. I don't know what that is either.
Anyways, the thing that like really, that was really alluring about the donair meat was that I found them both like quite intensely peppery. Like there was like a warming black pepper flavor, a lingering heat after like while I was eating it. And then I was maybe it's the same meat. I have no idea. But anyways, worth an investigation, perhaps.
Yeah. Worth a counterculture investigation, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably the best place for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I need people to curious, go eat with me.
I want to know, if you ask questions, I want to know what they say. Mm-hmm. If they're going to be like super cagey about it. I think, I don't know. It's funny. I guess like in my head, because I don't really feel like I ever need to protect my kitchen secrets or anything.
Right.
I feel like that culture is like going away. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I run up against it all the time where people are like, no, well, we can't tell you that. And I just think it's so funny.
But it seems like something that like they donair shop owners probably don't get asked a lot.
I'm sure you're right.
Just because it's like a quick service, casual, often late night kind of like no one cares. We know what a donair is and we want it and exactly. We're here. It's not like, what's the opposite? Like, I don't know, just like the more, more precious dining experiences where you want to make sure that, is this in house? Is this imported? Is this, but like donairs.
You don't think the donair shops get that? Did you?
I don't think it's common for them, but I don't know.
Where did the pork, beef and lamb come from? Which farm did the pork, beef and lamb come from that's on your skewer?
Right. Well, that's right. Yeah. Like I'm thinking of the Portlandia sketch about the chicken and how many friends the chicken had and what its name was and stuff.
What was its name? Do you remember?
No, I have no idea.
Damn.
Okay. I'll look into it. I'll report back. There's 6 weeks from now, we'll have follow up on that.
This is like a perfect lead in to our actual topic. Too bad we have to break for the intro now.
Oh, great. I hope it's your turn. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sotheby, and I'm here with Donair aficionado Shale McDonald.
Hey, Alan.
Oh, hi. We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it.
Okay, Alan.
Is it okay that I said Donair aficionado? Or?
Oh, yeah, it's great that you, I feel honored that you would bestow that upon me. I don't even know, like, I don't know if I can honestly live up to that. I'm going to have to start eating more Donairs now.
Now, we will have a Donair episode. And so...
So you can look forward to that.
Let's bone up.
Shale and Alan describing delicious Donairs.
You know, it's really similar to the last Donair I ate.
Yeah, exactly. And I asked where they get the meat from, and they wouldn't tell me, but I think they all get it from the same place.
Right. I think it's worth, we should, I've got a few places that have been recommended and a few places that I like. I think that we should check them out. And I think that could be an episode.
Yeah, I'd love to go on a Donair tour with you.
I really am not trying to hijack this episode and make it a Donair one, but like, I'm so skeptical of, because if you look at the Wikipedia page for Donairs, like it says that it's invented in Halifax, Canada. There's no way that's real. There's no way that's possible.
Why?
Because they serve them on every corner in Zurich, Switzerland. How could something from Halifax be the staple post-bar food in Zurich? How is that? And Berlin and like all of the like red light districts in Europe, like people go for Donair kebabs after the club.
Right.
And there's no way that that started in Halifax. It's ridiculous.
Here's what I think.
Okay.
Obviously, it's not Canadian food.
No.
Right? But the kebabs that you get, like, in Europe are pretty far from, like, what you get when you order a Donair in Canada. Like, it's different. You get different meats on it. It's spiced differently. Like, it's not always, like, it's often, most often, I would say, not ground meat. And so, like, more like what we would think of here as, like, a shawarma or something like that.
Right.
And so, I just think, I mean, obviously, it wasn't invented in Halifax, but maybe its modern form in the way that we have it in Canada and the way that a lot of people now also understand like what a Donair is in the States. I think maybe that came from Halifax.
Mm. Okay, let's look into it. There's definitely, definitely like if you're in Europe and you get a kebab, it's definitely not the same thing as a Donair. But if you're in Europe and you get a Donair kebab, it is definitely, it's a sausage type of
sausage
spiced
meat
sliced in bread. I don't recall having the like syrupy sweet white sauce on it.
Definitely not sweet sauce. I've never seen sweet sauce in Europe.
The Donair meat itself, it's there. And that's what they call it. They call it Donair kebab. So I don't know. Anyways, that's another.
I mean, it didn't come from there either. It came from where? Somewhere in the Middle East, I'm assuming.
Yeah, or Turkey. I don't know.
Turkey, yeah.
Someone probably already knows all the answers to these questions. And we'll just invite them on the show.
we can get the exclusive Donair interview. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was watching a Matty Matheson video the other day, and he was making something to do with the Donair. I can't remember exactly what it was, but he had sweet sauce to go with it, and he was like, this Donair that I'm making is based off a recipe from a specific Donair shop in Halifax. And I was like, oh.
Okay.
Yeah. There definitely is some kind of Halifax origin for like the North American Donair. So,
Okay.
I'm curious to find out. Alan, this is the first time in like a long time that I've been drinking a beer while we're recording the episode.
I saw that. A dark beer.
Are you jealous?
Looks very dark.
It is.
Last Best.
It's from Last Best Brewery. Mm-hmm. And it's called Dirty Bird.
dirty bird. The dirty bird gets the worm.
That's the saying.
Why is it called dirty bird?
I don't know. Yeah. I guess because it's dark. Hmm. Maybe it's made out of eggs. I have no idea, Alan. We're never going to get to our topic. This is the first time that we've really spoken since like the holidays. How was your holidays?
Oh, they were great. Pretty restful, actually, all things considered.
Oh, that's great.
But most importantly, my favorite Christmas present was that I got two packages of Momofuku instant noodles. I don't know. I can't remember what the official name of them is, but like the, you know.
I saw that you posted a picture of them on our Instagram.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And I just tried one of them a couple of nights ago. And so, I don't know, you want to talk about it now or we're already like 3 hours into our... I think what we should do is actually I'll share a packet with you and then we can both talk about it.
Oh, that would be amazing. I'd love that. I don't know who got them for you, but are they hard to get?
No, they're not hard to get.
Like,
but
you crazy expensive to get because you have to have them shipped from the States or...
They're not hard to get. Like I don't think that you can walk into a store in Canada and buy them off of a shelf. You have to order them online. But if you they're shelf stable, and if your order is over $50 or something, then shipping is free. So they're not difficult to get. Embarrassingly, I have no idea how much they cost because it was a gift. So that would be an.
I'm proud of you for not looking into it.
I'm just lazy. but yeah, one of the packs has like six or so packets in it. So I'll share one with you and you can eat it, take notes, and we'll do a full review.
That'd be awesome.
And your holidays?
My holidays were also great. I had a great time. I don't know. They felt a little bit not very restful. It felt a little bit like a rush to get things done. And I kind of, because of how things worked out with my schedule at work, I like all of my days off fell on the actual holidays. So it was sort of like I just had my regular weekends.
But you had to cook for 20 people or something.
Yeah. So it felt a little bit like I lost a couple of my weekends, leading up to the holidays. And then, because I don't know, you know, because at work people take time off during holidays. We were a little bit short staffed in the interim too. So it was a little bit like a bit of a rush, but I feel like kind of on the other side of that now. Hopefully I can take a little bit of a break in January while it's still a little bit slow and I can have some downtime and think about things to talk about on the podcast.
Not that we're short on things to talk about.
No, of course not. I mean, generally, honestly, I feel like we could probably, like, we do have something to talk about on this show. We do have a topic. I'm sure people who have looked at the title of the episode know what that topic is already. But honestly, I feel a lot of the time like we could just get on the call and just start talking about food and just come up with an hour worth of things to say. Like right now, I feel like we could continue talking about doners and noodles for like another hour and have an episode in the can and leave our actual topic for another episode, but not going to do that.
Oh, we're not. Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I was just going to say sometimes the topic as we have pre-discussed it, like makes the conversation much worse or much less fluid than it actually would be. If we just got on and talked.
If we just talked about it, yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. Sometimes we talk about it ahead of time and that sort of like takes some of the spontaneity out of it. Okay, I'll spill the beans.
Okay.
I think we mentioned it on the show a few times, or at least once, I know for sure. But a long time ago, I think, right? Like sort of near the beginning of your cooking career, I think... If I'm not mistaken, you read Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I did.
And to some extent, it had sort of that and maybe some other books and some other reading had an effect on how you approached your career and some of your some of your passion for food and cooking and things like that?
Yeah, I would go so far as to say, like, even forgetting about my professional career, it was two books that I read around the same time, Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan and The 100-Mile Diet by two authors, Smith and McKinnon, that, like, I had kind of, like, stuck my toe into professional cooking, but these two books, like, made me just really appreciate food and be interested in it. And they were kind of like the portal or the doorway into just food, sure, as a career, but also just the importance of food in my personal life and like with my relationship with Lisa and stuff like that. So yes, Omnivore's Dilemma.
Right. And I think then fairly recently on an episode, I mentioned that I'd never read it and you were
aghast.
Yeah. Justifiably aghast.
Right.
And I took it upon myself to read it or to listen to it, which is what I chose to do. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I thought we should talk about it. I don't think I've done very many like book reports. And so I thought it would be fun for me to do one once.
Yeah, you did one kind of with Bill Buford's Dirt.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, but okay. Yeah. Well, I guess this is my second book report then.
It would probably, because even though I've returned to sections of it many times, and even I think the last time we were talking about it, Shale, it was that corn sex thing. We were talking about corn, like the plant corn, and there was some detail about it, how it pollinates and reproduces that I remember right. saying, oh yeah, like there's a section in the Omnivore's Dilemma about this, that we read from, but it really does tie into lots of conversations that we've had, even if we didn't bring it up specifically. But it mm-hmm. has been probably 15 years since I read it in its entirety, and even though I've returned to parts of it, I'm not as fresh on it as you are. So maybe if you want, fair. Like you could give your kind of, your what synopsis and hot take. And then I'm sure mm-hmm. that there will be, questions I have or parts that I remember that we could discuss. Is that a good?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have some things that, while I was reading it, notes that I made, a few things here and there just to sort of that like I found interesting or sort of sparked me to think about like other things that we've talked about on the show and stuff like that. Mm. And so I have, you know, a few notes about it, and I'm curious to get your opinion on some of those things. And I'm sure once we get into it, we'll never get out of it.
Right. Real quagmire this episode.
That's right. So I guess I'll give my like sort of, like you said, my hot take, I'll give my sort of like overall impressions of reading the book. I should have written down when it was published. Do you know when it was published?
Yeah, it was published in 2006.
Okay. So yeah, obviously that's quite a while ago, almost 20 years at this point. And so I would say like my overall impression is that like reading the book is really interesting because I understand like how influential that book was to a lot of the discourse that we have around the sustainability of food, and it like in the years since that book was published. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and during that time, although I'd never read the book, I am immersed in that culture, mm-hmm. the culture of discussing food and the sustainability of food. And a lot of what the book covers is like the dangers and the non-sustainability of factory farming and monoculture and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think when the book was written, a lot of that information and a lot of that discourse was a lot less sort of
common knowledge, kind of
common. Yeah. And the book is really influential in that way. I think it brought a lot of, or it like made some really cogent points about things around those topics. And then I think provided a jumping off point for a lot of reasonable discourse about those things, and also a lot of like hot takes, conspiracy theories, all kinds of other sorts of like maybe less constructive discourse in the time since it was published. I think like some of the information in it has been like taken and sort of twisted into ways of like calling out people's arguments for sustainability and things like that. So it was really interesting while I was reading it to sort of like, it's like, this is a stupid analogy, but it's like when you're listening to Stevie Wonder and then, and you're like, oh, I don't think I've heard this song before. And then you're like, oh, wait, no, I have heard this song before. I've heard it like 100 times. Oh, no, wait.
It's a Will Smith
song. I've heard a hip-hop song that samples it.
Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, that's what it was like reading the whole book. It was like listening to a hip-hop song that, like, or, like, the modern discourse is like a hip-hop song that's, like, constantly sampling that book and is, like, listening to the original material, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mostly liked it. Reading some of it felt like a little bit of a chore to read. And I think the reason for that is just because a lot of it to me felt like old information, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
Because it is now or something, you know, like I haven't read it before, but I've read a lot of things that have come from it. And I've talked to a lot of people about similar topics. And I think in a lot of cases, probably in your case, like probably a lot of, you know, your opinions about food and sustainability come from things that, ideas that you developed while reading that book or ideas that Michael Pollan developed while researching it. Mm-hmm. And so like parts of it to me felt a little bit like retreading, you know?
Right.
But I still enjoyed it in the context of like, you know, actually seeing like the source material for a lot of these discussions that I've had with people throughout my career and stuff like that. So it was really interesting in that way. I think like I do enjoy Michael Pollan's writing, but sometimes it's like a little, I don't know how to describe it. It's like maybe sometimes a little bit over the top in terms of how the prose that he uses, I think, can be a little bit dramatic sometimes for some things.
Right. Okay.
It's sort of, I don't know, it's weird. Like every Michael Pollan book I read, I'm like, there's like, I was going to get to this later, but like there's, so... There's a lot of that in the book, like just sort of like, you know, overly philosophical or like sort of like he's, you know, I don't know. It's tricky because like he's really good at picking apart his own impression of something and like breaking it down to like sort of give the reader like picking apart the problems with it, you know, like his own biases. He's really good at picking apart his own biases when he's like talking about editorializing about the information that he's researched and things like that.
Right.
Because, you know, the whole book is like an editorial comment on a bunch of research that he's done.
Yep.
And some of that research is like hands-on. Like he went to some farms, he did some hunting, he's an avid gardener. So he's got a lot of like hands-on, you know, things that he did to research the book. And then also a lot of reading and, you know, he footnotes a lot of stuff in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, he's really good at like, in a lot of cases, like looking at the information that he's editorializing and then like, sort of backtracking to sort of deconstruct his own bias about it. Mm. But at the same time, he's not like shy about going kind of like off the deep end philosophically in terms of some of his editorial commentary. I don't know
right.
how better to describe it than that. It's a little flowery for me sometimes.
Yeah. It's kind of in a way, like say in a smaller or sorry, a shorter medium, like something like food criticism, it's expected that the authors, like they can describe things, but at the end of the day, readers are looking to them to take a stand and to say, well, was it good? Was it bad? Was it something need to change or what? And in long form journalism and nonfiction, it's like readers are looking to them to say like, well, what does this all mean? Like, what's the, like, we need you to interpret this for us. And so I appreciate what you're saying, but it's kind of, I feel like it's part of the format, is part of the medium in a way where it's like, well, like we don't want to just hear you describe a fast food meal and like what a feedlot looks like, but like tie it all together for us. What does it mean? You're published in the New Yorker or whatever. I don't actually know much about.
Yeah. Well, like that's not really the part that I have a problem with. It's like, you know, like I really do think that he is very good at telling us, you know, at distilling down the information that he has and like creating some kind of like, you know, although it may not be specifically like one-sided, oftentimes he like breaks things down, you know, from multiple perspectives, like his own sort of feeling about it, but you know, the countervailing arguments about it and things like that. I think he does a really good job of that. It's more like when he gets romantic about things that I can find it a little bit like a little bit over the top. Mm-hmm. And I think that like maybe some of the books of his that I've read more recently rein it in a little bit more. And there's like, I felt really kind of like tricked in part of the book, and it's on purpose, but I also found it a little bit annoying because it's sort of not fair play because some of his writing can be a little bit like, you know, like overly romantic and stuff like that. Like the prose that he writes about, you know, like the things that he's passionate about and stuff like that. When he starts, I was going to wait till later to sort of drop this, but like it fits so well here. But like there's like a part. So the last, or is it, can't remember. I think it's the second part of the book is about, oh no, the second part of the book is about like organic farming and stuff like that. So I think it's the third part of the book. Oh yeah. The third meal is like the meal where he has to get everything himself. Right.
Yep.
And the beginning of that part is he wants to go hunting. There's like a chapter that starts when he's like going to be going out like on a pig hunt, I think. And he starts it off with this like really like romanticized sort of like purple prosy kind of like talking about like the hunter in the woods and, you know, the elemental nature of, you know, man versus beast and all this stuff. And I was like, geez, this is a lot. And then he like at the end of the paragraph, he like leans in and he's like, just kidding. Like, that's not actually how I feel about it. And he like actually calls it out and like then goes back and is like, you know, a lot of writing about hunting is like this.
Yes.
And I think that I, after having an experience with it, I think I maybe understand why. And then he sort of deconstructs it. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really feel like it was fair play because like it was really over the top and it was extremely sappy and it really did get me. And I was annoyed by it. But it was like a little too close to some of the things that he actually says, like in all seriousness, to where I was like, not really fair play, Michael Pollan. Like, I don't know.
Right.
Like, well, he got me. He
got you.
He really did get me. Like, absolutely. Like, but yeah, I felt like it wasn't really fair.
It's, I couldn't recall, any of that writing specifically, but I think my recollection is that it's warranted because you almost expect that's where the book is going to go. It's the book is broken into three parts. The first one, like part one, is called Industrial Corn. Not Industrial Corn, but like it's part one, Industrial, and the title is Corn. And then part two is Pastoral, and the title is The Farm or something like that.
Yeah.
Is that right? I can't remember.
And, I can't remember.
And then part three is Personal, and it's called The Forest.
Yeah.
And so because of his, the opening section about industrially produced corn and beef is so, sometimes nightmarish, sometimes Brave New World-esque, I don't know. Like, it's just, it's so wild. And like these weird juxtapositions of like unimaginably, the unimaginable waste and excess and expensive inputs to these systems just to produce a handful of items that consumers want.
Along with like pollution and...
Yeah, like, it starts off very bleak, and so and then you get the middle section that is really about the, if I remember right, like the kind of overarching story is they talk a lot about small hands-on farms, and especially Joel Salatin, who's a farmer, I think, in Virginia or West Virginia. One of the big points of that middle section is like the growth of what he calls big organic. So it's like, it's like organic to the letter of the law, but it's practiced on an industrial scale, which a lot of people who, you know, say in the 70s, they wouldn't have thought that was compatible with the idea of organic farming at all.
Right.
And so it
almost, he talks about Earthbound quite a bit in that section.
And we can revisit some of these, but like it almost seems like this the trajectory is kind of like, well, maybe we should all just kind of like 100-mile diet style. We all need to have hands on our food and eyes on our food and be intimately familiar with how it's produced and who we're buying it from and all that. And so I feel like I can't remember reading that section in particular, but I feel like he's worked for that. Where he's like, oh yes, now finally we've arrived at the easy, like the obvious conclusion that we should all just forage our own food and grow our own food. But then of course, like the name of the book is Omnivore's Dilemma. And the point is that all of our food decisions are very tricky for us, especially in the modern age, but
yeah. And certainly the book does not land on like that it's sustainable for everyone to procure all of their own food from places where they know where it came from. Like, he's very realistic about that. And there is like a very romantic, like, I think like one of the last three or four chapters in the book is just like, you know, very romantic chapter about where all his food came from for the meal that he prepares sort of at the end of the book, which is like, you know, supposed to be the food where he understands the origin of all of it. Mm-hmm. And there is a romantic couple of paragraphs there that I did feel like he had earned.
Right.
So yeah, my overall impression, I like the book. I think I like reading Michael Pollan. I just feel like for me, a lot of it was like old information, and some of the like chapters about industrial farming and stuff, I tuned out for a while I was listening to it, because I was like, yeah, I know all this, you know, like I understand this, like I already have been inundated with information about it, you know, but I can see in a different context. You know, even if I had read that book in 2006 or 2007, I'd already been cooking for quite a while, but I think that a lot of that information would have been a lot fresher for me and probably would have been a lot more impactful if I had read it back then.
I think too, besides the book itself, there was a movie called Food Inc. And I don't 100% know what the relationship between Paulin and the producers of Food Inc. mm-hmm. was, but it was essentially like a documentary version of The Omnivore's Dilemma. And it featured, Michael Pollan featured in it. Like, he was interviewed extensively throughout it. And it actually followed, maybe not on the wild food and foraging front, but a lot of the stories in The Omnivore's Dilemma were told in that movie. And for instance, like that Virginian farmer, Joel Salatin, like he right. is interviewed extensively in the movie. And
Cool. I have seen Food Inc. I should rewatch it now.
Yeah.
I
feel like I had read the book before I saw that movie, but that the documentary did a lot to bring life to some of the stories that are told in the book, and especially Joel Salatin, who's just like, he's portrayed very vividly in the book, but to see him on film, like, he's just like so charismatic and like a talker, and mm-hmm. can just, you could sit and listen to him for hours, and a really unique guy.
yeah. During a lot of the time when Michael Pollan was describing his farm, do you remember can't remember the name of his farm.
Of Joel's farm?
Yeah.
Oh, I couldn't tell you. No, I couldn't.
Damn. I wish I could remember, but I had a lot of images in my head while they were, Michael Pollan was talking about that farm, and I'm wondering now if they're from that movie, you know?
If
they're from Food Inc. Like, because I've seen Food Inc.,
yeah.
but I didn't realize, you know, but I have in my head images from watching Food Inc. of like farms that are similar to what Michael Pollan was referencing.
Yeah.
And so I wonder now if I go back and watch Food Inc., if I'm going to be like, oh, that's what I was picturing when he was talking about Joel Salatin's farm.
Yeah, that's
farm.
Funny. Yeah. Like, yeah. The movie incepted
your
image of it. Yeah. Yeah.
yeah. So then, yeah, and then I guess like quickly, you sort of already got into it, but like, yeah, the book is called The Omnivore's Dilemma, and Michael Pollan took that nomenclature, that turn of phrase from a anthropological paper,
yeah,
about human eating, I guess, and the paper basically goes into detail about the difficulty for animals that can eat all kinds of things in, in being able to find foods that are safe for them and that like help and that fit into their ecosystem so that they're easily accessible and that like, I think it's part of the paper. It sort of like posits that like maybe one of the reasons why we have like a really good visual memory and a really good taste memory is so that if we eat foods that wind up making us sick or something, that you know, will stay with us so that we don't wind up doing that again later on down the road.
Right.
And that I think it's also within that paper, or maybe it's in another, can't remember, but I think like the like trigger of disgust is like also associated with that. Like,
right. It's kind of like the actual dilemma is that because whether it's humans or rats or whatever, like as an omnivore, the dilemma is that you actually, there's much more that you can eat in the world than if you were, say, a cow who needs to eat grass.
Or a carnivore who needs to eat meat.
Yeah, exactly. But that means that also the possible dangerous or poisonous or even deadly things that you could eat are also much more. And so every time you look at a piece of food, you have to ask yourself, do I know that this is safe to eat? And, or could it be harmful to me? And the irony in the title and that the book really explores is that it's kind of easy for us to picture that dilemma for like a prehistoric hominid where it's like, well, I'm walking through the forest and here's this plant or here's this creature. I'm hungry. Maybe.
Can I eat it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But the irony is that now in the industrial and post-industrial age, we are faced with the same problem, because even if you're walking through the grocery store, you might ask yourself the same question. You know, like in post-industrial North America with, you know, obesity and diabetes and things like public health concerns like that, where it's like, well, mm-hmm. should I eat this? Like, is this good for me or is it harmful to me? And so that's the the disturbing irony at the core of the book. And that's kind of how the book is framed, right? Well,
yeah,
I mean, finishing with
he comes back to it in like all of the sections.
Yeah.
And sort of relates it in a different way in each of the sections. But yeah, that's sort of like the, I don't know. It's really clever. The title and sort of the overarching conceit of the book and that central irony is really, yeah, I think it really does a lot to help tie the book together or like unify things. Mm-hmm. Here are some of my thoughts from things that like sort of wormed their way into my head while I was reading it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thing one, we were both right about the corn thing.
How do you mean?
Well, actually, that's not entirely true. I was wrong because the conversation that we were having on the conversation that we were having on the podcast was about fertilization, mm-hmm. was about like pollination. And yes, corn can really easily pollinate. It's really good at that. Mm-hmm. But modern corn does need humans to reproduce. And that is because
you mean the F1
corn
hybrids.
Seed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not only F1 hybrids, but Z maize, like older. So he goes into a lot of detail about the origin of like, you know, corn that we grow in modern times, not necessarily sweet corn, but varieties that are used for industrial purposes. Mm-hmm. But he talks about the origins of those varieties and like more than a couple hundred years ago, there was propagation of a strain of corn in North America called Z maize. I think South American, like native South Americans were like the first ones to really pollinate corn and come up with this hybrid, mm-hmm. I guess, called Z maize. And even like older varieties of Z maize, like not just newer like GMO hybrids and things like that, but even older strains of corn require human intervention to plant. So not to pollinate, but to actually plant, because the husks on the husks that like cover the seeds are too thick. Like they need something to break the husk open in order for the seeds to be able to get into the ground.
Oh, okay.
So we were kind of both right. That like I knew that there was some sort of human intervention required for corn propagation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, really the conversation that we were having about was pollination, which is, yeah, you were right about that.
Is Z maize, is that like the scientific name, like it's ZYMAIS or something, or is it like the letter Z?
I don't know because I didn't read it. I only heard it.
Oh, sorry, I see.
So unfortunately, I can't answer that question.
But do you know what I mean? Like it could be like, from an American's pronunciation, it could be like the letter Z dash maize, or it could be like a scientific name like Z maize, like ZYMA, whatever.
Yeah, it could be either okay. of those things. Shall I Google it?
No, it doesn't matter.
Okay. You know, there really is a lot of information about corn in the first portion of the book.
It's basically like, I mean, corn is the subtitle to the entire first third of the book. Even mm-hmm. though really it's like the whole first section is about industrial agriculture and husbandry, but it's about corn and beef in North America. That's what the first chapter is about. Yeah. And the other fun conceit in the book is that each of these three sections is it culminates in a meal that he eats, right? Isn't that's one of the things?
That's right.
And so the meal at the end of the first section is him getting drive-through McDonald's and eating it in his car with his kids, right? Is that, am I remembering that right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But yeah, corn and beef as the two pillars of the American agricultural industrial complex.
Right.
And for me, like thinking back, even if I knew something about feedlots at the time, it really was the corn story that I would like found the mm-hmm. most troubling, like in,
it, oh yeah,
the, in terms of monoculture plantings, but also in, there was, maybe you'll perhaps be able to discuss this more than me, because just because it's been so long since I read it, but there was some connection to the planting of corn and the use of fertilizers to a bunch of industrial products that were left over from the Second World War, where it's like
right.
during the Second World War, America especially, but you know, most industrialized nations needed to amp up production for nitrogen compounds used in explosives, and that when
that's
the
right.
war was over, they were awash in these and found that they could use them to fertilize corn crops and things like that. Do you remember any more specifics about
right.
that?
Right. Because before the Second World War, yeah, no, you're right. So before the Second World War, there was no... Let me see if I can remember this correctly. So there's a thing, there's a synthetic way to create
fixed nitrogen. Fixed nitrogen.
Called nitrogen fixing. And that was invented in order to be able to take nitrogen from sources that wherein it was difficult to retrieve the nitrogen from it in order to use nitrogen to make explosives for the Second World War. So nitrogen fixing was invented to allow the production of synthetic nitrogen sources for explosives for the Second World War. After the war was over, all of the combatant countries had a ton of these nitrogen compounds still kicking around, more than they knew what to do with. And so they decided that if they could convince farmers to use it as fertilizer, then they could unload it. Mm. And that basically resulted in, you know, modern industrial monoculture.
Yeah.
I don't think that there was like, that was like a decision that was made to try to push everyone towards monoculture. It's just like a cascade of effects that happened after that, mm-hmm. You know, from farmers being able to grow way more on a certain plot of land due to these synthetic fertilizers. And then, you know, and then the propagate or the modification of plants that would do well under those conditions. And then, you know, just sort of like those things keep leapfrogging each other until you basically have a monoculture of corn that you get most of, like, I can't remember what the numbers are in the book, but like, you know, it's 60 or 70% of like the food that goes into the average eater in North America comes mm-hmm. from corn.
Yeah, that to me, that was one of the really, and to be honest, I don't know how it affects the way that I eat and cook now, but that was a really eye-opening, the really eye-opening part of the first section of Omnivore's Dilemma. Things that we take for granted, say corn and beef, especially living in Western Canada. Corn isn't as essential in Western Canada as it is in the American Midwest and stuff, but things that mm-hmm. you take for granted as these wholesome foods that have you would imagine have been around for time immemorial are actually like the effects of very, very recent history. And so in that way, like it, not to completely drive this conversation in a different direction, but there was another book that I read around the same time, and was really common in a common required read in university in the early 2000s, and it was called Guns, Germs, and Steel. And
another book I haven't read, but I've heard a ton about.
Right, by Jared Diamond. And one of the sections of that book is about the advent of agriculture, like how agriculture was discovered mm-hmm. and why it started where it did in the hubs of civilization, like Mesopotamia and places like that. Mm-hmm. And that was really eye-opening to me, like just as a what an amazing fluke agriculture is to begin with. And then reading Omnivore's Dilemma, it was kind of like connected dragged those ideas of like the principles and fluky coincidences of agriculture's origins into and through the industrial age, like with the Fritz Haber process and fixing nitrogen and developing fertilizers mm-hmm. and all of a sudden being able to produce, which had never happened before in the history of humanity, being able to actually produce enough food to feed, 7 billion people and more. And so it was really, again, like, how did it change how I cooked? I don't know. And like, how does it affect how I eat now? I don't know. But it really was mind-opening, hearing that story for the first time, the story of fertilizers, monocultures, industrial agriculture, and why we eat, or why the things in the grocery store are so common and so cheap, basically.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, I sort of like started off by saying that, like, I felt like a lot of this was old information for me, but like there was a lot of stuff that I didn't really know specifically either. And that like maybe I kind of like had a vague idea of, but that Michael Pollan does a really good job of like deep diving on, like the nitrogen fixing thing, or, like the thing that like kind of, I don't know, blasted my brain a little bit when I was reading the first part of the book is that like we can produce corn so prodigiously and so cheaply that like
it's we a can problem.
that we can, well, yeah, that there's too much, so much that we don't even know what to do with it. But then also like we can turn that into beef or meat, like chicken, like most of the chicken, beef and pork that's raised in North America is raised on corn mm-hmm. because it's such an abundant source of nutrients and like we can produce so much of it. It's just like makes it so that even though like when cows eat corn, like 80 or 90% of the energy that's contained in the corn, goes to waste through the cow's digestion, it's still cheap for us to eat beef that's made from corn, even though it's even though we're getting like a tenth of the nutritional value,
right,
by doing it that way,
and that now that we're talking about more and I'm reflecting more, like that really was one of the central ideas of the first part of the book, is that due to, say, whatever you want to call it, like historical circumstances, it became very cheap and easy for us to produce corn in North America, but then the very abundance of corn was a problem that needed to be solved, and on sheer economics, like we have all this, we have this resource. How do we use it? And that gave birth to all these different industries and eating habits. And I remember one of the lines that is just like absolutely, burned into my brain from the first section of Omnivore's Dilemma is the hoard must be consumed. We have all of this stuff. It must be from economics, like we need to get it off our hands. We need to sell it. It needs to be consumed. And we found ways to do that. And that was, that was like the disturbing, under theme of the first section of the book. And they talk about all kinds of ways that hoard of corn is consumed. They fractionate it and they make it into this starch and this sugar. They feed it to corn animals. Oil,
tons of different kinds of corn starches.
We burn it in our vehicles.
High fructose corn syrup. ethanol. Yeah.
And I'm sure, I can't remember the line or whatever, but I'm sure that when Paulin is eating his Big Mac or whatever it is in his car, I'm sure he draws parallels to I'm burning some corn ethanol in my car as I drive it, and I'm drinking high fructose corn syrup in my Coke and whatever, and the beef that I'm eating was fed the corn. That's the really crazy intimate relationship between corn and beef in North America, is that we're all eating it all the time.
The beef is corn.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Yeah. it's beef, but it's made with corn.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's pretty shocking. That section had a lot of bits and pieces in it that sort of reawakened my sort of just attentiveness, to that type of thing. There's a few sections about fad dieting and stuff in the first section of the book too, just because it's talking about part of the solution to the problem of having this glut of corn is trying to get people to eat more.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's been that's been an actual driving force for the economics of food in North America for the last 50 years because what he sort of says near the beginning of that chapter of the book is that the food industry, economists and industrialists expect growth, mm-hmm. right? And the only way for a food company to grow is to be able to sell more food. But there's only a certain number of people, and they can only consume so much. And so how do you get around that problem? Mm-hmm. Well, you try to find ways to encourage people to consume more or to purchase more and not consume it. So, right. There's a lot of it was pretty rough. Mm. The first section of the book was pretty depressing. Interesting, but pretty depressing.
Well, so I've got a question. So I read that around the same time as I read the 100-mile diet, and I was involved mm-hmm. in the slow food movement in Edmonton and things like that. If I look back compare my attitudes now to what they were then almost 20 years ago, at the time, say circa 2006, this book was kind of a galvanizing thing for me. It was industrial food is terrible. And I should never mm-hmm. eat industrial food. I'll never go to McDonald's. And around that time, I almost never went to McDonald's. Mm-hmm. Now, 20 years on, I actually have despite those feelings then and having read the book, my feeling about it is actually much more casual, where I don't mm-hmm. think it's good to eat at McDonald's every day. But if I take my kids on a road trip 3 times a year and we stop at McDonald's those 3 times a year, I'm not really it's not an existential crisis for me. It's it's there and we're on the road and we're going to eat it. And I don't feel bad about it.
I think near the end of the book, Michael Pollan literally says that all of these things we have no choice in that they exist. Right. Mm. And it's our own choice for how we approach it. And I think he's referring to the meal that his forest meal as a Thanksgiving or something.
Okay.
It's a special meal that, you can only have once in a while. And that, he thinks that maybe that's how fast food should be treated as well.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
which is basically exactly how you just described it. So I think it's kind of interesting.
That's quite vindicating.
You guys aren't at odds yet.
And that is like, I mean, obviously it's not the same thing like in, like growing up, being born in the 80s and growing up in the 90s, like going to McDonald's is not the same thing as a Thanksgiving meal. But in terms of like how often it is experienced and how it might be appreciated, it's kind of sad to me to think that a McDonald's meal would be as treasured as a Thanksgiving dinner. But yeah, like
that's not really what he means. But that like you could have it as a novelty, right?
Exactly.
Instead of having it as like a staple.
And that's why, like, I don't know exactly what year it came up, but like around sometime within a few years of this, the documentary Super Size Me would have come out, which really, like, even though it it discusses some of the same problems with the like vertically integrated food system that McDonald's and other large corporations have created, what that documentary is really about is like it's a problem when it becomes somebody's daily habit to eat that food,
right?
When it becomes the daily habit of a society to consume food in that way, as a one-off experience or an occasional experience, like I'm not an ideologue about it anymore. Like I'm not going to judge someone for eating a Big Mac. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. And neither am I. And that's sort of like when I was reading the book, that's sort of the experience that I was having is that, like, you know, I know a lot of people who read this book and had, a really intense ideological reaction to it, and it changed their way of interacting with food. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's, I don't know, it's like he even says at the end of the book, like, it's not a solution, like nobody's going to be able to, in the way that our food system currently is, that nobody's going to be able to sit down to every meal knowing where all of their food came from, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like aspirational, that you can do little things and try to, you know, try to put yourself in that situation as much as possible, but, you know, it's not a sustainable solution to the problem, you know. It's also interesting that, like, McDonald's, for instance, would not exist if it wasn't people's daily routine, you know. Yeah. Like if it was a thing that, like, people ate for the novelty of it, like twice a year or even once a month or something like that. Mm-hmm. Most people, there would be like one in Edmonton.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Like you'd be able to support one or something, but it's the fact that like there,
it would be the Yarrow of Edmonton. They would be.
Right. Like exactly.
Would, yeah. There would be one and a few people would go there.
There would be one because like, you know, people going to a restaurant like once a year or something like that. Yeah. Can support like a small footprint, but like, it's because there are like droves of people who get their breakfast 5 times a week or 3 times a week from McDonald's or 3 times a week they take their kids there because it's an easy way to get a meal or whatever. Mm. That's why you can have one or two in every neighborhood in the city. Mm-hmm. You know, that's tricky. It's a real dilemma, Alan. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, no, really, like, yeah, sorry. I know what you did there, but yeah, it is like, you think about, like when I bike to work, like I go by, there's a McDonald's in Kingsway in Edmonton, like kind of between Kingsway Mall and Kingsway Station. And there's probably a lot of, maybe there's a lot of commuter traffic, like a lot of people who are stopping there for coffee in the morning and for whatever it is, lunch. But it's also like, there's a lot of people in that neighborhood who save up money until they can go and get a drink. Sorry, like go and buy a Coke and go and buy fries so that they can eat something. And it's like a weird, like, is that a public service? Is it opportunistic? Oh, I mean, it's just everything. Yeah. Like it's
is
all
it destructive?
Of it. It's just like,
is it
it's
opportunistic?
Just, but it really is like, it's a hub of that community for better or for worse. Like Like there's people like sitting in the snow outside of that McDonald's eating the fries and drinking pop, like because that's what they're going to eat that day. It's really, yeah, it's.
Yeah. And like inexpensive access to food is like an important human right and an important part of our society. And, you know, should be that that's something that everyone in the world should be able to expect. And on some level, like processed food creates a system whereby you can make food cheaply accessible to people. It's just like, you know, obviously the like tricky part to navigate is that that's driven by capitalism. Mm. And so it, the cheap food isn't worth anything to anyone if it's not making the company money. Mm. And so, you know, it's really difficult to tease those things out, like to separate those things. Mm. And I think if there was like a legitimate wedge to like separate those things, that, you know, we could have a much more sustainable industrial food system, you know. Mm. But
okay, so I think we have a pretty good idea of the first section of the book and right. how it made us feel. My memory of the second section, section two, pastoral, and it's called The Farm or something like that.
Right.
And the two things that I remember are Joel Salatin, the Virginian farmer, who is the, like when you picture a, I don't know what if Americans call Virginia the Midwest or not, but like a rural populist, eloquent, charismatic farmer who does everything by hand because he believes it's the right thing to do. There's that story, which is really charming.
Polyface. That's the name
Polyface,
of his farm.
Polyface, right.
Yeah.
A really interesting and charming story with like deep philosophy behind it. And the other part, and I don't even remember any of the names from this, but the other part of the second section is that is this idea of big organic, someone who started basically mm-hmm. as a hippie in the 60s and 70s, was into organic food and growing your own food, but then ended up like developing a huge company that produces food that is technically organic, but is made on such a scale that his the folks that he hung around with in his 20s, you know, they think that he's a corporate hack sellout. Right. And so it was his conundrum of like, have I sold out? Well, actually, I'm probably doing the world a solid. And even if I'm not as strictly adhered or I don't have the same principles as we did in the commune in California in 1969, I'm keeping a lot of chemicals out of our drinking water and things like that. Mm-hmm. That's all I remember the second section.
Yeah, that's basically the gist of it. So I think it starts with like, I think it starts off like sort of discussing organic food and what that means and like the origins of it. And then it starts to talk about, big organic, which is sort of like this, basically a separate industrial food system.
Yes.
So like the non-organic, you know, corn growing, CAFO beef raising, system that uses chemical fertilizers and GMOs and things like that. There's like another basically like smaller but very similar system that creates food in North America that is like technically organic according to the legislation. Mm. And basically what that means is that there are, you know, it can't have like synthetic chemical fertilizers, pesticides, bunch of stuff like that. But so, and so these large organic food operations have started to rely on like animal manure and things like that instead of chemical fertilizer, which might be good, but they need a lot of manure. So they need a lot of animals. And so basically then there are feedlots that feed cows organic corn and take the organic manure and turn that into fertilizer for organic farms. It's just sort of like, you know, has turned into like a different set of industrial farming concerns.
Right.
And it still is, you know, there's just no way to grow food on the scale where you can sell it like nationwide or globally, even in some cases, without adopting monoculture. And so, you know, there's like a really interesting story about Earthbound Farms in the second part of the book, where it was basically an accident that they wound up selling like spring mix, like mesclun grains. Right. I forget exactly how it happened, but like spring mix wound up just sort of being like a, they were growing a bunch of like organic lettuces and things, but like because of timing and stuff like that, they wound up with a lot of small plants that they had to pick at certain times, and they just had like a whole bunch of them, and they decided to brand it as like a salad mix and put it in a few grocery stores.
Right.
And it started selling really well. Mm. And then they basically, to keep up with demand and to grow their business because of those economic concerns, they basically had to turn it into like a huge industrial monoculture. Eventually Costco came to them and was like, hey, can you supply Costco's with organic salad greens? Oh no, actually, an interesting part of the story is that like, so they were selling these organic Earthbound organic mesclun in grocery stores like all across Canada and the States. Mm-hmm. And at some point, Costco came to them and asked them if they would supply them as well, which is like a huge contract. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to take it, but Costco didn't want organic on the label.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I don't know, I guess they just thought that that would turn off some of their customers.
Right.
And so Earthbound made just a different packaging for their organic mesclun that just didn't say organic on it. Mm. So for years you would go to Costco and buy Earthbound spring mix, and it didn't say organic on the container, but it was came off the same farm as
right.
the organic stuff. So, which I think is pretty hilarious. The second part of the book just does a lot to illustrate that, like, you know, there are still big problems, like even in organic food production, because it's very difficult to reach a critical mass of food that you can then, you know, like have enough that you can distribute it in a way that keeps the price down, while avoiding monocultural agriculture. So,
and what was the kind of like I remember how I reacted to Joel Salatin and the story of Polyface Farms, especially having seen him in Food Inc. Was there mm-hmm. some kind of takeaway or critique in Pollen's story about that side of it? Was it like, you know, this works well for this guy, but it's not scalable or not everyone can do it? Or what was there any?
Well, that's the trade-off. Yeah. It like, you know, like I think like the thing that kicks off that part of the story for Pollen is that he's like really interested in that type of food, like, you know, farms that
are self-sufficient. And so any manure that they need to grow plants, they have from the animals that they're raising, and the animals are grazing.
Farms that don't rely on monoculture, but that, you know, have like a self-sustaining ecosystem.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have their own animals, and they use the manure from those animals to fertilize plants. And then they feed the plants to the animals. And then they, you know, it's like, an ecosystem. Mm. And Pollen was very interested in that as sort of like a tonic for the the rise of industrial organic. And so he contacted a farmer that he'd heard about, this guy, Joel Salatin, at Polyface Farms, and was like, hey, can you send me some of your food? And Joel was like, no way. Like, we do not ship our food. Like, there are like three or four ways that you could get our food, and it's all like, you know, right around us locally. And, you know, it's part of our philosophy that we don't ship our food, and here are the reasons why. And, and you know, the reasons why is because when you start shipping your food around the country, then, I mean, you're like, even like, even if you take ethanol out of the equation, like, you're still, you know, dipping your toe back into that industrial, you know, like that industrial system that, you know, is not sustainable and that, you know, is causing pollution and, you know, is a, you know, a big carbon producer. And, you know, it's just, you know, and so, like, philosophically, he was just not going to send any food to Michael Pollan. And so that prompted Michael Pollan to go to the farm.
Right. Yeah.
And then he was there for several days, and he worked on the farm for several days. And that's sort of like the big portion. I think that's the largest section of the second part of the book, is like, he works on the farm. He has a really, you know, he learns a lot about how the farm runs, and, you know, Joel tells him a ton of things about how they balance it, how they are able to keep the balance, like, down to, there's like a whole bunch of forest on the farmland.
Right.
It's like, I think it's like the farmland is like one quarter sort of like farmable land and like three quarters forest. And they have to keep the forest like, in the proportion that it is, because it helps with the water table. It helps with like microbes in the soil. There's like all this stuff. And yeah,
right.
Michael Pollan does a really good job of outlining it all in the book. I think because probably Joel Salatin is like a font of information about it. And like, I think in the book too, they say that like, it's Joel's grandfather that started that farm and like started planting trees on the hills to like keep the soil from eroding and like all this stuff like 150 years ago or 100 years ago or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, that part's really interesting. I think, you know, like, I would have thought that my favorite part of the book was going to be like the like foraging and hunting part or something. But I think my favorite part was like, yeah, reading about Polyface Farms. And I mean, there's a lot of this kind of a lot of political statements in it from Joel and stuff like that. And, you know, that I think, you know, are what their opinions, but at the same time, like, and I think Michael Pollan says in the book that, like, you know, there's no way to have a farm like this or farms like this in every area of the country so that people could have their food needs met only by these types of farms.
Right.
Like, it's not sustainable in that way.
But where it is,
you know, the fact that you can make a choice to have that also available is, you know, I think, I don't know, it's just like the best balance that can be struck in our current situation, I feel like.
I remember, so thinking about Polyface and, say, Joel Salatin's refusal to ship food to Michael Pollan, I remember at the time, like, because of this book and 100 Mile Diet and stuff, people would talk about food miles, right?
Right.
It's basically like, well, how far has your food traveled to get to you? And one argument, counter argument, whatever, that came up sometimes, like when I was in university, people would point out, like, if you take a step back and you think about the actual like energy inputs and economic inputs, like, food miles are not they're not the only thing. And just because something has traveled a short distance to get to you doesn't mean that there was less energy put into getting it to you. Well, okay, so tell me maybe you weren't actually working in Alberta at this time, but like, when I was at Jack's Grill, there was like this really big issue where the chefs wanted to support local, but a lot of the customers preferred New Zealand lamb to Alberta right. lamb. And it was like this thing.
There's some interesting discussion of New Zealand lamb in the book, actually.
Oh, is that right? Okay. So maybe that's the origin of what I'm about to say. Like, and so I was like, well, we should use Alberta lamb, but then certain guests would say, oh, Alberta lamb is so gamey. Why can't you just get New Zealand?
It's your favorite, God, Alan, your favorite word. This is the heart of our podcast right here. This is like everything converging. Everything's going to implode right now, and we're going to just turn into a singularity.
All we need to do is get Donaires back into the conversation. But I do actually remember like the dumb debates that you have late at night when you're in your 20s and you're in a frat house or something. And it's like someone said, mm-hmm. like, well, like, you know, New Zealand has the perfect pasture land to raise lamb with the least energy input that you could possibly need. They're grass fed and finished. They do not supplement with grain. They don't use whatever hormones and all that. And then mm-hmm. the carbon emissions of shipping them across the world to us are actually, you know, negligible compared to the carbon emissions that are made by trying to raise lamb in other parts of the world. Whatever that may be, I'm not explaining it very well, but like,
right.
And similarly, like for years at Elm Catering, we got a lot of our meat from Pine Haven, which is a Hutterite colony out in Wetaskiwin County. And mm-hmm. I've been there two or three times to just like to have a tour and see their operation. And the beef, I don't know if it's changed, but at the time, the beef was entirely grass-fed and finished. And mm-hmm. the poultry and pork operations were not. They were like in intensive industrial closed barns, and like it wasn't even part of our tour. It was just like, you can't go in there. Like that's a industrial thing going on, and it's not pretty. And yeah. the man who like led the meat company at Pine Haven, he was like, I just wish people would eat more beef in Alberta, because like for the way that they produce it, it was by far the most sustainable and environmentally friendly, because we have such abundant grassland that doesn't like that just naturally supports. It used to naturally support bison, and now it naturally supports right. The beef in our agriculture industry. But the inputs are so low compared to something like raising pigs, which need grain and stuff like that. So in a way, like one of the things that this book and 100 Mile Diet, like it kind of coined the concept of food miles, which it like in retrospect is very simplistic, but it on its own can't be an indicator like of how sustainable or low emission a process is. But it started an important conversation, I guess, is what I'm getting to, but
yeah. Well, like, I don't know, like this is just dumb back of the napkin math, but like, you know, there is some reality to that. Like you sell, you know, like 100 chickens, but each one of them takes a separate ride in a separate vehicle from the farm to the person's house or whatever, right. or to the place where it's going to be sold. Or, you know, if you put 1,000 chickens on a truck and transport them, you know, like then you've got 1,000 times that 20-mile journey, you know, mm. before you hit that. So like, you know, I'm not arguing for industrial farming, but like I you know, like I do think that like there are efficiencies that you can find when you like scale things, and I think that in a lot of circumstances you know, these types of narratives about food, you know, leave some of that, some of the actual math out of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would never argue for CAFOs, but you know, like there has to be some efficiency. Otherwise, you know, you don't get sustainability, right? So, mm-hmm. and some of that efficiency might not look great to, you know, eyes from some perspectives, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting too. Like, I haven't really had to talk specifically about this book for many years. And so now, like, one of the most important issues in our society is the cost of living. And oftentimes in the news, that comes down to the cost of groceries, which is a great mm-hmm. indicator, like, you know, because you buy them at least once a week and you feel it in your checkbook when because I know, like, you know, for years and years, it's like our family of four, like our grocery bill was $300 a week. It's more complicated than that, but like for dairy and vegetables, it was like $300 a week. And now it's mm-hmm. usually close to $500 a week. That doesn't include meat and stuff, which we don't buy at the grocery store generally, but that's a different conversation. And so that's another piece of right. it, like to be in this current time where the cost of food is significantly higher for a lot of items, double what it was when I would have read this book,
at least.
It's just another kind of shade to cast on the story. And it's like, well, yeah, what do we value in our food? Like when I was 20 and didn't have kids and had disposable income, like I didn't really balk at paying $25 or $30 for a chicken at the farmer's market. But then it's like, now how do I feel about it? Yeah, it's mm-hmm. funny. I haven't even thought about that until this conversation, really.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. it's tricky. I was having a lot of feelings while reading this book. Like, mm-hmm. so yeah, like moving on to the third part of the book, you know, it's supposed to present sort of like the
is
most
that really how it's
sustainable
framed?
Case, right?
That's what you expect, I think. But like, is that really what he's says?
Sort of.
Or?
Like, I mean...
Oh, okay. Okay.
No, certainly not by the end of it. But I think like part of the conceit going into the third part of the book is that, like, you know, that he's going to find and source all of his food and, you know, pay no money for it because he's finding it all himself or foraging it or hunting it or growing it himself. So, you know, it's very cost efficient and it's, you know, very local and, you know, very... I don't know, ecologically sound, I guess, theoretically. But, you know, the last part of the book is like, you know, it's like, I think probably the most challenging for him to have researched. Like he has to go on all these like hunting expeditions and foraging expeditions and has a really tough time with it. And he has like good people sort of like helping him through it. And it's still like, you know, very difficult for him to go and they go and hunt a pig. And like, that's, you know, really hard for him to do. Mm-hmm. Most of it he can't do himself. You know, the foraging part is like really interesting. He talks a lot about mushroom hunting, which is like also this like really mm-hmm. weird, elusive kind of practice, you know, where you never know what you're going to come out with. At one point he talks about his idea for an appetizer mm-hmm. was that he was going to serve abalone that he like collected himself. And like, he like almost gives himself hypothermia trying to like get abalone. He finds out while he's like trying to collect abalone, like, I guess like off the mm-hmm. coast of near San Francisco or wherever he is, that like it's more dangerous than like it's more people die from like trying to collect abalone right. than in all hunting accidents in the entire United States like in a year or something, because like it's just really dangerous because mm-hmm. you can get pushed up against the rocks by waves and it's really cold. And he like almost gives himself hypothermia and like gets one viable abalone that they basically eat on the beach before he leaves to go home. He never even got enough to like make his appetizer out of. And I don't know, like he's very romantic about it. And he's like very romantic about all these experiences. And I think like he, you know, is mm-hmm. really excited to be like learning these new things. But, you know, it's just like, you know, when it comes down to it, the meal that he serves is like a once in a lifetime situation, you know?
Well, okay. That's actually the third section is the one that I remember I don't remember it very well. I'm sure that is almost everybody's experience, mm-hmm. like first getting into hunting and foraging. Like, yeah, it's not easy at the start. You definitely get better at it. Like if you do, you know what I mean? Like it's a skill and it's a wide set of skills. And there are people who not many, mm-hmm. especially not where we like not in urban centers, but there are lots of people who do get an appreciable part of their diet from hunting and foraging. So it's, you know, and Michael Pollan is with.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Right. And some of the people that are helping him along his journey are some of those people.
But yeah, it's definitely not about, a,
you know, like, yeah.
Panacea. Like, oh yeah, if we all just foraged our own food, then, you know, all these problems would go away. I don't know. Do you think that, is it fair to say that the third section is the least fleshed out and properly explored just because of how, because of this, you know, the specific broad skill set that you need, and, you know, you kind of have to come up in that and practice it. And he's definitely a tourist or a dilettante.
Yeah. I would say like what makes the third part of the book compelling is like not so much like his journey about learning how to hunt or forage or make the meal or anything like that. It's sort of like the interstitial tissue when he's talking about those things that like delves into the ethics of food and the ethics of eating. And he talks, there's like a pretty interesting sort of exploration of ethics of veganism and vegetarianism and how that relates to you know, ecological sustainability, and that, you know, it's really difficult to sort of like tease apart making dietary choices like that and what the impact of those choices actually has on the broader sustainability conversation and things like that. And I think there's a pretty cogent exploration of the ethics of those things. Like he doesn't, you know, he doesn't like say one way or the other whether he thinks that it's good or bad for people to be making those choices, but he does explore some pretty interesting ethical avenues, like that, you know, are pretty, you know, like I think, like, you know, for a lot of vegans and vegetarians, it's the ethics that of making that decision that like, you know, caused them to make those decisions or feel passionate about it. And there really is some like muddy water there if you explore, you know, like how that really shakes out in like the food, in like agriculture and the food procurement process and stuff like that. Right. It's not, it's not ethically black and white. And so that was pretty interesting. And you know, it's fun to hear him talk about cooking, I guess. A little bit. I don't know. It's kind of interesting. Like the cooking stuff, I was like, I don't know, his choices for the things that he makes are kind of weird. Like it's also like he wants to make this like multi-course meal that has like the idea of the meal is that it has like meat and vegetables and grains, and it has something that's like hunted and something that's foraged and something that's grown in his garden, and it has to meet all these like criteria and stuff. But then there's like, while he's describing it, there's like a few loose ends where I'm like,
like what?
Like he kind of skipped over this. Like he makes bread,
like an ingredient, and how?
Yeah,
right.
So he makes bread, and he talks a lot about how he makes his own, like collects wild yeast and makes his own starter for his bread and stuff. But, you know, like he doesn't really say where he gets his flour from. I don't know. It's possible he got it from somewhere local. Maybe.
Acorn flour.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Or like, you know, near the end when it's coming, he's actually going to have to produce the meal, he decides that it's okay to like have some of his friends bring some things. So like, his friend Angelo that took him hunting offers to bring some pate, and he's like, yeah, that's fine. But he doesn't really know where the ingredients in that pate came from. Like part of it came from the pig that they hunted, but part of it didn't.
Right.
And then his friend also makes fresh pasta. So where'd the flour for that come from? Like, I don't know. It's like interesting. There are a lot of details that are kind of glossed over. And when he gets into the actual like presentation of that meal and like talking about how he produced it, you know, like there were a lot of corners where I was like, you know, I feel like there's probably some shortcuts here, and he cops to some of the shortcuts and stuff, like, and he cops to like, you know, he had made decisions about what he wanted to do and then had to break them, you know, break sort of promises that he made to himself based on what was actually attainable and stuff. And so, you know, like it's not like he's trying to hide anything necessarily, but I think that they're like, he winds up inadvertently hiding more than he thinks that he is or something. I don't know.
That's basically inevitable in the wild food space. I know that there's always like the purists who are like, there's even, you know, restaurants who are like, we don't use lemons or pepper or anything because they don't grow in Canada and stuff. But one thing, okay, so the Omnivore's Dilemma like discusses the issues and ethics and economics behind a lot of this. And it was all very interesting to me. The reason that I really loved The 100 Mile Diet, the book, is that it impressed upon me that like your feeling of connection with the food, whatever that means, is the most important bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so like with respect to wild food, like if you go hunting and you get ducks and geese, you should enjoy those ducks and geese. And if that means that you're putting them into a jalapeno popper with processed cheddar cheese and it's wrapped in bacon, that's fine. That's up to you. Like that's how you enjoy it. That's great. If you want to be a purist and stuff, whatever, like if everything needs to be wild, fine. But like if you go through the experience of procuring that food and you take the time to appreciate it and share with other people, then like that is what it's about. And so, right. I'm not upset if Michael Pollan used Robin Hood flour in his bread.
Neither am I, and neither is he. Like, right, you know, that like he really is, you know, like the point of the end of the book is that like, you know, he feels like the important thing is like feeling like you can have some kind of story about understanding where your food came from, you know, like,
and not a story like that you can share on Instagram, just like,
no,
you're like, as a human being, you get to participate.
You have an understanding of like the narrative behind where the food that you're consuming, how it came to be, you know, in your mouth or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I liked it. I think, you know, like I said, a lot of it was a little bit overly romantic for me. And then a lot of it was like rehashing information that I feel like is pretty common knowledge, you know, at least for me.
Because he wrote this book, that's why it's common knowledge, Joe.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Which is, you know, like, and that's amazing. Like, yeah, it really was like listening to Stevie Wonder in that way.
I guess
now I have to go and read The 100 Mile Diet because apparently that's like Alan's real food Bible.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.